we finished with Parak Dalet in the last class, and we're starting in Parak Hay. And we ended with Esther agreeing to go into the king, King Ahasuerus, and she requests that all the Jews fast for 3 days. And that's where we stopped off. Now, what I wanted to do is that in looking through the next parak, Parak Hay and Parak Vav, I thought very long about it, and it seems that there's a saying from Perkei Avos, Perek Bet, that applies to this as a theme for this class. And the comment is from Rabbi Tarfon, and he says, "Hu haya Omer lo alecha hamlacha ligmor, velo ata ben chorin levatal mimena," which means that you are not expected to complete the work, but you're not free to evade it. Okay, so that's the theme for the class. So now we'll start with Parak Hay. I'm going to go through quickly in English, and if you want to read through it in Hebrew at the same time. So Pasuk Aleph starts that it was on the third day that Esther puts on her royal clothes, and she goes the third day of the fast. And they say that the Chazal said this is actually the third day of the first day of Pesach. Okay, that she's going to the king. And she puts on her royal clothes, gold and silver, and she goes through the palace to the inner courtyard of the king, and she's facing his throne. And Pasuk Bet says that he sees Esther, and he extends his golden scepter out to her. And Pasuk Gimel, the king asks what she wants, knowing that she's risked her life to come to him. So it must be a very great request. And then he offers her up to half the kingdom. That's how much he loves her, and that's how much he understands that she... Right?
Everybody knows 50-50,
no more than that. And that she must be making a great request to have put herself in danger. Pasuk Dalet and Hay, Esther invites the king and Haman to come to a special banquet that day. Pasuk Vav goes on, it says, during this mishteh, the king again asks Esther what she wants. He's waiting to hear this major request of her. Pasuk Zayin and Chayin, Esther asks them to come again to another banquet tomorrow. That's her request. She also reveals at that time that she's going to do what the king wants of her, which we really know is that his major request of her is to find out who she really is, what her identity is. Okay, that's underlying this. Pasuk Tet, Haman leaves very happy, joyous. He's thrilled. Here he is that he's been invited to the queen's banquet and alone with Ahasuerus. She's like on a high. Then he goes out of the palace and he sees Mordechai, and Mordechai does not stand or bow to him, doesn't get up for him, doesn't do what he's supposed to do. So he's furious. Pasuk Yud through Yud Gimel is basically that Haman goes home and he summons his friends and his wife Zeresh. Says his loved ones and his wife Zeresh. His wife Zeresh is not included in the loved ones. She's this incredibly supportive wife. Anyway, he tells them about all his money, his successes, his sons, his great life. And then he says, yes, Pasuk Yud Gimel, yes, all this is worth nothing to me as long as I see Mordechai HaYehudi sitting at the king's gate. Okay, all he's got, all in the world, but he's not satisfied because Mordechai won't bow to him. Pasuk Yudal at the end, basically Zeresh, his loving wife, suggests that he build the gallows and have Mordechai hung on it. So he does all this. Okay, we're at the end of Hay. And then his friend, Zeresh is like Haman in giving advice, ready to give advice, right? You know? Okay. So now he's happy and he goes to. And he's going to go to the Mishta happy. That's the end of that term. So in looking at Esther again, she's agreed to go into the king at the risk of her life. Now that she's gone to this point, she has to begin her actual work, her avoda. She has to start a plan. She starts by asking at the end of Parak Dalet for fellow Jews to pray and to fast. She also prays and fasts, and then she implements her plan. She has decided she's going to have Ahasuerus and Haman come to a seuda, a feast, a mishneh. Now, Esther is basically following in the footsteps of our forefathers. In dealing with her enemies, Yaakov, Yaakov Avinu sets the path on how to deal with enemies. When he deals with Esav, when he has to meet Esav again, Rashi brings down that there are, in Vayishlach, Perek Lamed Bet, Pasuk Tet, Rashi explains that there are three components to prepare for enemies. And Yaakov sets this tone for us through history. One is davening to Kodesh Baruch Hu. A second is bribery, or sending gifts, presents, which we know he sends to Esav presents. And the third is preparing for war. He divides his camp, etc., etc. And actually, in the end, Yaakov does fight. He fights with the angel. So it's three pieces: tefillah, gifts or acts of kindness, presents, and preparing for war. These are the same three components that we'll see later on that Esther uses. First, she davens to Kodesh Baruch Hu, davens and fasts, tshuva, that whole aspect of tefillah. Second is the gifts, which is the mishteh for Haman and Ahasuerus. This is the way, they call it bribery or whatever, it's buttering him up. You can do this for the good, and you can use this method for anything, as we know. For children, bribing them, getting them to, reward, and the honey on the letters, or whatever it's a valid means. And then preparing for war. And at the end, we know that actually at the end of all this, Esther can do only up to a certain point, and then the Yidden has to, in Perek, I believe it's Zion, and we know that in the end, Esther has to actually put into place that the Yidden have to fight back. They cannot withdraw the decree that Ahasuerus and Haman made. They can only allow the Jews to know about this decree and to prepare them, and they're allowed to fight back. So there really is the third component of war in this case. So let's look a little bit at each. First of all, tefillah. For 3 days, Esther, her maidens, all the Jews of Shushan, fasted and mourned in Davin. This is tshuva and tefillah. Now, the Me'am Loe says that 3 days of fasting and mourning brought Esther into a very high spiritual state. Okay, and this includes the tefillahs of Klal Yisrael that were also for her to be successful. So she did her own tefillahs and fasting, and the tefillahs of Klal Yisrael behind her.
They all know she's gone?
I don't know if they knew the details of the plan as much as they knew that she was going to go to Ahasuerus, and they knew that she had requested that they daven and fast for 3 days. So on the third day, Esther goes into the palace, into the king's courtyard. And the Medrash says that she actually goes down a long corridor. And it reminds me, it's like some of these palaces, and the Versailles Palace, they say, has this long corridor of mirrors all the way down. And as you enter, it's to create a kind of a fear and awe that you're walking down this long corridor before you get to the king's palace. And it's a marble or gold or whatever, and riches, and it makes you feel long, tall corridor. It makes you feel smaller and smaller and smaller as you walk down this corridor. And she is pouring her heart out to Kodesh Baruch Hu. Now, it says that actually, the matter said that she's actually this long corridor, and it says she's going into the king's courtyard, HaMelech. Now, the Melech, we know, wherever it says in the Megillat Esther, the Melech is the Kodesh Baruch Hu, as well as Ahasuerus. But in a deeper level, it's the deeper meaning is that it's the Kodesh Baruch Hu. She is going to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. That's her goal, to get to a Kodesh Baruch Hu in most intimate of places, to talk with and to plead for Klal Yisrael. Now, Esther is going uninvited. You're not allowed to go to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But she's going uninvited. And it says that as she walked through this corridor, she went with confidence. The confidence and humility. The humility to know that she's very small. She's not allowed to go into this corridor. But the confidence that she has to go there. That she has to do her job. That she has to save Klal Yisrael. Now, it says that when she got to this royal chamber, it was full of idols. Okay, this getting through there was full of idols. Now, you can't be thinking of Kodesh Baruch Hu, why in front of an idol? But what's her choice at this point? She felt the loss of the Shekhinah at that moment. That where there's idols, there's not Shekhinah. That's why they had to go out of Mitzrayim to pray to Kodesh Baruch Hu, right? Because Mitzrayim was full of idols. And that's why they kept requesting, we have to go out of Mitzrayim to worship a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So she felt the loss of the Shekhinah at that moment. And she felt all alone. Back to the aloneness that we talked about in last week. That she felt all alone. Here she is in this corridor of idols. Here she is trying to get through. And daven to Kodesh Baruch Hu, but no Kodesh Baruch Hu because it's full of idols. What's she going to do? She's stuck in this place. She felt completely alone. Now they say that at the moment, at the crucial moment of a Nisayon, we feel very far away from a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And that's part of the Nisayon, to find Hashem, even though it feels very far away. It says when Avraham Avinu went to when he went to find the mountain, the Har Moriah, to daven to Kadosh Baruch Hu, and he was looking at it, it says he saw Hamakom Mirachok. It says exactly Hamakom Mirachok. Now we know Hamakom is the place. Makom is also Kadosh Baruch Hu. Mirachok means from far away. He saw Hamakom Mirachok. It means he felt very far away from a Kaddish Baruch Hu. Just at the moment that he needs to feel close to a Kaddish Baruch Hu, because he's going to sacrifice Yitzhak, and he has to bring his son, his only son. At that moment, he feels the most farthest away from a Kaddish Baruch Hu. So at the moment in the Sion, we feel very far away from Hashem. And that's when we have to build and pull our Amunah. The Reish Yitzchakma, which...
Is that just... That's part and parcel of the Sion.
You feel alone.
The fear. Isn't there anybody? The ones who manage, the ones who realize that they're not going alone. They're with Hashem. Those are the ones who realize for themselves that they're going through this very difficult thing with Hashem.
But they're with Hashem is not necessarily feeling Hashem. They're putting themselves.
They're physically scared.
The ones who make it. In the making it, it's not just that they go through the Messiah and that they don't...
That they pull Hashem into it.
Right. Or convert, right. But that they feel Hashem.
That they pull Hashem into it.
They pull Hashem into it, but they're really physically scared.
Definitely scared.
They're scared, so if he's distant, then they don't feel good. They're frightened, and if he's close, then he's with them.
So look what it says here. The Reish Yitzchakma, it says exactly what you're saying. It says that the Reish Yitzchakma is a mutter sefer based on the Zohar. And it says that Esther cried out to Hashem, and we know this from Tehillim. Tehillim Chaf Beis, Pasuk Beis. Keli, Keli, Lama Azvatani. Hashem, Hashem, why have you forsaken me?
So she felt alone.
She feels completely alone. She feels that Hashem forsook her at that. Forsook?
Hashem has forsaken me.
Whatever the grammatical tense is, Hashem has forsaken me at this moment. I feel left alone. I feel that without a Kaddish Baruch Hu. When she was going through the poster, and she says, Kele Kele, Lama Asvatani. Why have you forsaken? It's amazing. If you read Chafet, and you're supposed to read this actually for Purim, on Purim Day, and I think also time is Esther, but and if you read it, it's exactly the story of Esther. Exactly. It goes passage by passage. And we'll see later on what happens, but...
I
don't know the answer to that. I can only tell you from what it says about Avraham Avinu and his final Nisayon with Yitzchak. I mean, that's a high level, and he still felt Hamakom Mirachok, that Hashem was, and maybe that's on each, like, on his level, on the tzaddik's level, of on his Nisayon level. So if we had his closeness to Hashem, it wouldn't be a Nisayon for us, right? Our Nisayon wouldn't be a Nisayon for us if we had his closeness to Hashem. Mm-hmm. But Hashem maybe puts him on his Nisayon level, that also Mirachok, for him to build that closeness to Him, because by going through that Nisayon and pulling on Hashem, even when you don't feel His closeness, is making it, when he gets through that Nisayon, he's going to be that much closer to Kadosh Baruch Hu. So I don't know what a tzaddik goes through in terms of his level and where he's at. Mm-hmm. But I assume if he's still in this world, then he still has Nisayonah. Mm-hmm. Because there's no way that someone's in this world without Nisayonah. Mm-hmm. That's just not, he wouldn't be here. He has to have his
tikkun. So there's a constant devekus with
her. There's constant devekus. What that devekus means on his level, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And Avram is still close to Kodesh Baruch Hu, but doesn't feel Hashem's presence. So he has to pull on himself to find Hashem, to talk to Hashem, to relate to Hashem, to be with Hashem. But he doesn't feel Hashem's presence with him.
Is that because there's a small makom that's a doubt, or a small makom that says, this seems bad even though I know it has to be good? In other words, what is the darkness?
That's what it says about Avram. He had all these... the Satan sent him all these pictures, why he shouldn't kill Yitzhak, that he shouldn't, getting through the river to get this, all these things, a million rationales why he shouldn't do it. And he had to fight through every single rationale why it was not a good idea for him to do this. So whatever, and we all go through that in every Nisayon that we have, that, oh, the other side looks much like a better idea. That's what we talked about last week with Esther. Esther had a very good rationale why she shouldn't go into Ahasuerus. So what happens exactly, on a high level of, higher level on a tzaddik? No.
My resources are nothing. And even if I had conceived that Hashem is such and such and such and such, and that was with my resources, that is also nothing. That Hashem is everywhere. And I just have to experience that complete emptiness to allow what Hashem really is at a time when it's so bad I can't even be distracted by thinking about resources. I don't have any resources. That sense of emptying oneself when a mismatch can be built, we can screen Hashem out by thinking we can do this and we can do that, and we have such and such an understanding.
There's a place, the deepest place of tefillah is that moment. That's the deepest place of tefillah. That's one of the three components, tefillah. Right? What's one of the three? So, in fact, what you're saying is that it says that she stood in that court and she immersed herself in tefillah. And Rav Shlomo Akibitz, he wrote Lecha Dodi. And he said, Tanya, what you're saying, he said that he also wrote, besides Lecha Dodi and many other things, he also wrote a commentary on Esther. This is in 1595. Okay, and he said that she stood in that court, on that prisoner, in that hallway, before she got to the king, and she totally immersed herself in tefillah. She became a tefillah. That's the last news. She herself became a tefillah, and she part of that tefillah of herself was actually tefillah for Beit HaMikdash. And as we know that at the end. And in terms of Beit HaMikdash, her son, Dayavish, was the one who started the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, but at that moment, when she was all tefillah, her whole being became a tefillah. Now, she had to pass through, it says, it's brought down that she had to pass through seven doors to enter the king's throne. So in this proof door, there were seven doors. At each of these doors are guards, right, protecting the king. Now, in a mashal, on a higher level, these are the seven levels to heaven. And there are guards at each of these seven levels to Shemayim, okay? This was her real goal, to reach Hashem's throne room. Okay, here she's going to Ahasuerus, but she's really in this process reaching Hashem's throne room. And this is the level of tefillah that breaks down all the barriers. Look at what Tanya's talking about is that going straight to the will of a Kaddish Baruch Hu, going straight to the innermost chamber of a Kaddish Baruch Hu, the Kaddish Kedoshim, to align oneself totally with the will of Hashem. What does Hashem really want? What is His will? What is His his thought, his being? To go and put yourself totally in Hashem's mercy, totally in Hashem's will, to do what He wants, to become one with Hashem, to let go of everything else and be tefillah. Be a tefillah, that every bone, every sinew, every organ, every blood vessel, every cell, every thought, every emotion is one with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. And it comes out of pain and suffering, usually, unfortunately. But that's usually where such deep tefillah comes from. I mean, it can come from incredible simcha, as we know, in Sukkot and Simchas Beis HaShoeva. We can reach a high level of tefillah also through simcha. But right now we're talking about the pain and suffering. Without pretension, when you get to that level of pain and suffering, pretension goes away. It's totally humility. And to know only, like as an assistant, only Hashem can help. There is no way out but through HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That He is the ultimate creator, the ultimate mover, doer. He will create the situation and change it. But it's through our tefillah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can come and bring that in. It says there are many asfarim on tefillah, especially more Kabbalistic sfarim that talk about that there are things in the world, for example, and I can't go into them too much detail, but there are things in the world, that decrees that are made, for example, that a person, Chas V'Shalom, shouldn't have children, or a person should only live till such and such year, or that a person should have such and such pranasa, or not have pranasa, or whatever the situation is. There is a place of tefillah, an incredible place of tefillah, that a person can actually change such a decree. But it's not a regular tefillah, and I don't want to go into how you get this, because I don't really know, but it's not a regular tefillah, but it's a place of coming to the point of total oneness with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. And here she is, here Esther is in a room full of idols, passing from corridor, from door to door to door, with guards who, in this world, the guards are ready to stop her, because she's not supposed to go to Achashverosh without being called, right? But they see her going with such intense conviction, and it says, Me'amot says, with such confidence that she's going to go there. She's going to go there. So there's humility and confidence at the same time. It's not humility, I'm a shmata, I can't go. It's humility that only Hashem can help me. But I have the confidence that I'm going to go. I'm going to ask him. I'm going to beg. I'm going to get to Kodesh Baruch Hu. And the idols, it's interesting. These idols is our mind. Our mind is full of idols. Doubt, whether Hashem's going to give this to me, whether I'm good enough, whether I deserve it, whether he really can do it, whether this is really, whatever, all those rationalizations that we have. Okay, all these things. Those are the idols that we rely on. That we, you know, that's our stuff. That's our mind. It's the corridor of our mind that we have to go through to get to a Kaddish Baruch Hu. And in this tight place, there's no way out, right? Which is how Esther feels and how all of Klal Yisrael feels and how each of us feels in the Messiah, how Abraham felt, you know, here I'm supposed to be the father of the Jewish people, but I'm supposed to sacrifice my son. I'm sure he felt totally, as they say in Shir Shirim, the cleft of the rocks. There's nowhere to go. That bird that's flapping its wings, if it flaps its wings are going to be broken by the cleft of the rock. If it doesn't flap its wings, it's going to fall into the water and drown. There's no way out for this bird to go. That's how we feel in the Nisayon. We're fighting our way through our minds, through our feelings, through the physical Nisayon. But the idea is that ultimately, who can help us? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the most pure way, but through the most abandoned place, through the most humble place, most clear place, most simple place, but most convicted place and most confident place, that Kaddish Baruch Hu will help me. And this is connecting to Kaddish Baruch Hu. He wants to help us. He's not like trying to make the Nisayon to like punish us. He's making it to connect to him. That's what the Nisayon is. And this was Esther. And this is what Rav Alkabetz says when he says she was all tefillah. She was just tefillah. Her whole being was what had no barriers to Kaddish Baruch Hu. Not in thought, not in feeling, not any part of her goof was there a separation from Kaddish Baruch Hu. And in this chus, Hashem answers her. This is where Hashem answers her. So this is where we go, from the Chol Nafshecha, as we said in Shema, to the Chol Moedecha. She moves now into utilizing all of her skills, all of her being, to now continue to be with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, but through action. She's given herself over to tefillah, and Achashverosh points at Esther and says, okay, you know, what is it that you want, Esther? He has switched, okay? And now she has to do with a plan. Now she has to take, Netanya, all her resources and use them, okay? Up to now, it's b'chol nafshecha. She has to risk her life. We say in Shema, b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol me'odecha. And as we said, b'chol me'odecha can be actually a higher level, because now she risked her life, but she wasn't killed. Now she has to use her life. She has to use her brain, her body, her resources, her means to convince Achashverosh to work in this world. So what does she do? Now she goes to the shtarlis of gifts, presents. She invites Achashverosh to this banquet with Haman that day. Immediately, let's get started. Let's go for it. She makes a special banquet, special foods and wine, etc., etc. And what is she doing? She's getting him in a good mood. Right? She's going to make him feel special.
Special supper.
Special supper, right. She gets him in a good mood. She gets delicacies, et cetera, et cetera. There's a physical aspect to this. What's she doing also? She invites both Achashverosh and Haman. Now, one of the things she's doing is she's putting Haman off guard. He's getting a great ego from this, right? Haman's invited alone to the special suda, special mishnah, just the two of them, Achashverosh and Esther. And he gets to go along. He's feeling great. He's got everything, right? Then, and at the same time with Achashverosh, she's also working with Achashverosh, making him feel good, making him feel special, and at the same time, she's getting him a little bit jealous of Haman. Why is Haman invited? What's going on here? Okay, she's setting a scene. Then they say, Achashverosh asks her again, "What is it that you want? I know you want something. What is it that you want?" She says, "I want you to come to a second banquet." Now, we have to ask, here we've talked, the last thing class, we talked about Teresa's. She has to get going. She has to act. Why does she not do everything now? Why does she wait for a second banquet?
Development.
Here's the chance. Here's the chance.
Process.
Let's get started.
Process, development.
Why push off another day? When Mordechai really pushed her to act immediately. Isn't she procrastinating? So there's two things that are going on. Esther has to start the process. She has to act with reason. There's a time to act with reason immediately, and there's a time to act with patience and planning. Now, it takes a lot of wisdom to know the difference. But she had to start the process. She had to risk her life, but that's an immediate thing. You have to be able to willing to give up immediately. Like the act of Pinchas, immediately, to act immediately. There's a time you have to be willing to give up your life. The call Nashecha, that's immediately. But once she began saying yes to Mordechai, fasting for the three days, immediately going into Ahasuerus, not waiting for him to call her, but at the risk of her life, she goes in. Now her personal motives are gone. Anything left, she has let go of her personal fears, her fear of being killed. Okay, she's turned herself into a Kaylee to save Klai Yisrael. When her life is no longer at stake, she no longer has cheshbonos. She no longer has Megillah. She doesn't have to, you know, think about her own self anymore. She's given herself up. She's filled only with call motives. How to remedy the situation, how to solve it. And now she's moving with an intuition or Ruach HaKodesh and how to proceed. It says that once she has done this, she has a Kaddish Baruch Hu, she has opened herself up so much to a Kaddish Baruch Hu that she can intuit how to proceed. And she's working now with the situation. She has risen up to a higher level. Like when we go to a tzaddik for help, or for, you know, go to a big rav for guidance, he's working more in the realm of a Kaddish Baruch Hu. He is working in that level. And that's where she has risen. She has now sensitivity to work with a bigger plan, a master planner, a master designer. She's working with the Kaddish Baruch Hu now.
What was the process again?
She has, through her tefillah and through her giving herself up, through her willing to give up her life for a Kaddish Baruch Hu, for Klai Yisrael at this point, and she has gone beyond her own negius, beyond her own motivations, beyond her own fear of her own life. And she has risen to a level of working with the Kaddish Baruch Hu for Klai Yisrael. Uh-huh. So now,
the first is an act, an intellectual action.
Giving up.
Uh-huh.
Giving herself up.
Uh-huh.
So now she can work with the external situation, with Hashem's plan, with how the things have to go. Let's continue through and you'll see what happens. She can act the Chomo Dechel with all her resources to save Klai Yisrael. She can use any and all tactics. The first was this resus to offer her life. The second is this careful planning and action to do it right because she has Hashem guiding her. She can now, because she has gone into a Kaddish Kedoshim, she can intuit. It's kind of like what Ruach HaKodesh is, I guess, on a certain level. Remember, she's a Neviah. She has now Ruach HaKodesh. She has now risen to the level of Ruach HaKodesh that she can work with Hashem. Now, each of us in our own life can also sense when we're working with Hashem. Okay? She intuits that the time is not right at the first banquet to reveal everything to Ahasuerus. She intuits that there's more that has to happen, that he's not quite ready. That she set into play, she has created with Kaddish Baruch Hu this situation with the Seuda, but there is not quite right. She intuits that there's not quite right with Ahasuerus, and she would admit, whatever her intuition is, that she's working with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. Whatever her intuition that she's come to at that point, she intuits that there's more that has to take place. So she's going to wait 24 hours. Now this is the crucial turning point in these 24 hours. Now I don't know exactly what she knew, but she knows that there's something that has to happen, something else. And she says, okay, come to another Seuda. Maybe, and it says, the Midrash brings down that she felt that by being with Ahasuerus two times in a row, that he would have more, that he would love her more. Actually, there's Mamre Mordechai, which is written in 1585, says that she was trying to build an attachment to Ahasuerus even more. He felt it wasn't enough attachment. Now remember, in the with Vashti, okay, Haman convinced Ahasuerus to kill Vashti.
In a minute.
Right? Now, she knows that she's playing between Ahasuerus and Haman. She knows that she's this counterbalance, and she knows that before, Haman had convinced Ahasuerus to kill Vashti. Haman could easily convince Ahasuerus to kill her. She feels that by being with Ahasuerus twice, by making the suit twice and being with him, she's going to create a strengthening in love of him towards her. That's one of her realizations. And she's also, at the same time, going to build Haman's ego even higher. A second time he's going to come, he feels, Esther must really be on my side.
How much time is
24 hours. Okay, it's very important that we know it's 24 hours, because what happens in 24 hours is crucial. This, okay, another Su'uda. Okay, the first Su'uda is on Pesach, the first day of Pesach. Now she's inviting him to her second Su'uda.
So what does that really mean? She cooked something for him?
She made the best delicacy. Okay, and I'm not going to go into she's the queen and he's the king.
Right,
okay.
But basically they didn't really eat together normally.
I guess not. And the fact is that she's still fasting. She does not actually eat or drink at the Su'uda. And he invites her to drink, and she says, I want this to be for you. Okay. The Bayam Lois says that she also felt that she might be able to kindle a certain amount of jealousy of Achashverosh towards Haman even more. Yes, she's endangering her life further by kindling this possible jealousy, because maybe he'll be jealous of him and her and kill them both. But she needs to create a certain jealousy of Haman. Okay? It doesn't matter now. She's already willing to risk her life. So she's willing to risk her life a second time now by kindling the jealousy of Achashverosh. What Hashem tells you and doesn't tell you. Okay, so Nevuah is not so, like, you know, a call, you know.
I didn't say everything on the menu.
Not email.
But she, whatever it is, she's committed to this mission of saving Klai Yisrael. She's no longer scared for herself. But her cheshbonos, which came from a certain interest in Ruach HaKodesh, is enough to keep her working with Hashem. She's working now. She's sensing the situation, right? And she's working. She's using all of her feminine abilities, all of her kochos, all of her wisdom, to work. Now, we've seen it before. We see it in Yael, when she puts that tent peg through Sisro, right? She convinces him to come into her tent. She gives him, you know, food, and tells him to rest. He's tired. He's running away. You know, most of his army has been killed. She's going to hide him in her tent. And she gets him in her tent. She uses all her femininity, right? He falls asleep. And she, you know, this is what her intuition is bringing her also. Now, Esther is a partner with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and she knows that there is something else that has to happen, and she needs to create the space or time for it to evolve. Now, what she doesn't know is what else Hashem is going to do in the meantime. Okay, she doesn't know the future necessarily. She doesn't have to know. She has to work with her intuition and working from a completely altruistic place. Completely l'shem shemayim. She wants to save Karthel. She wants a Kadosh Baruch Hu to come back into the world, to bring back the Beis HaMikdash, to end the galus. She wants the Geula to come. She's working Hashem. So, therefore, Hashem works with her through the good. She is becoming a partner with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, which, as we described in the last class, is what our goal is in this world, what Hashem created us each to do, is to become a partner with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Now, I want to switch. I want to go through this quickly, because I'm going to have time. Hashem now, when we switch from Parak Hay to Parak Vav, Hashem enters the picture in a much more clear way. He's been in the picture all along, but we're going to see this incredible. This is now, folks. This is when things start to turn around. Esther waits the 24 hours, and her wedding is 24 hours. She has a cheshbon away in 24 hours. But during those 24 hours, all the necessary elements for Haman's downfall falls into place. So let's go to Parak Vav, and I'll summarize it very, very quickly. The first thing is that we're going to see all these components that fall into place. It's incredible. But Laila Hahu Nadadash Nat HaMelech. Parak Vav is on page 18. Yeah. Laila Hahu Nadadash Nat HaMelech. That night, we're not talking about it didn't happen 2 weeks ago or 2 weeks later. That night, the king's sleep was disturbed. Now, the king, on the simple level, is that it's the Achashverosh, right? Achashverosh could not sleep. The Medrash says that the heavenly throne was shaken. Hashem couldn't sleep. Okay? He never, the truth is, he never sleeps. He's always watching over us, right? Tilam says, He knows lo yishan shomei Israel. Hashem is always watching over us. He's never sleeping. But at this night, it says that after 3 days of fasting and tefillah of Klai Yisrael, and the crying and the wailing, Hashem's throne was shaken. And Esther coming and pleading, Hashem's throne was shaken. So he didn't sleep that night. Now, therefore, Hashem doesn't let Ahasuerus sleep that night. And Medrash Rabba says that, or before that, there's an incredible Gemara that says that that Ahasuerus was starting to be wary of Haman. He was getting, like, bad vibes, if you will, about Haman. Mm-hmm. He was starting to feel like, you know, what's he doing coming to this mishta with my wife? You know, what's
going on,
you know, what's going on here? Why is he there? And why is this? And is he what he says he is? And he's starting to have negative feelings about this Haman. And then he has a dream that night. Ahasuerus has a dream. And Medrash said that's what woke him up. He has this bad dream that Haman is standing over him with a sword. That's what the Medrash said. Now, it's interesting psychologically, okay, when we have a bad thoughts about someone, often we dream, right, about that thing or that person or that event, right? It's very psychological. So there's not a separation between psychology and the Kodesh Baruch Hu, okay? There's, you know, we often think, that's this. It's psychologically, that's a natural event. If you start to have negative, you know, feelings, Hashem was working through Teva, and he has this dream. Now, it sets the Teva is set in place. Hashem's setting the Teva in place. Now, it's funny, sometimes we can't sleep. Maybe Hashem's waking us up for something. Okay, maybe he wants us to do something in the middle of the night, daven or whatever, take the hillel, whatever, and think about something.
When a person wakes up in the middle of the night, it is because of that, but you're not supposed to just
let it go. Mm-hmm. It's better to get up and see the baby in the night. Maybe you want to turn over. Anyway, this is Balayla Hahu, that night, Zadadad Shanat HaMelech. Then it says in Pasuk Bet, Linon, v'imatzeik tuv asher higid Mordechai abifan v'seresh. It says there, and they found, they happened, okay, no, I'm sorry, before that it says, he can't sleep, Ahasuerus can't sleep, so he says, bring me the Sefer Zichronos, the chronicles, the book of the king's chronicles, the record book, bring it over to me. He has nothing better to do, he's going to look at the records, right? So then, maybe looking for something, but what does he open up to? Instead, it says in there what was written that there they found, they happened, okay, to open up to the situation with Mordechai informing on Bigson and Seresh. But in Pasuk Zimmo it says, Lo nasa imo davar, nothing was done for him, no reward was done for Mordechai. Then Pasuk Dalet, suddenly, Haman ba lechaser Beit HaMelech. Pitom, suddenly, out of nowhere, here comes Haman to the Beit HaMelech. Haman, we know, he couldn't sleep because he's all bent on this program to destroy, to hang Mordechai. And he comes running early in the morning he's going to wait there in the courtyard for the first minute that Ahasuerus wakes up, and he's going to get this new decree done to get rid of Mordechai. So he's waiting out in the courtyard. So Ahasuerus says, well, bring him in. So he decides, let's check out what Haman thinks. But you know, we don't know how smart or how stupid Ahasuerus is. There are many conflicting reports. But he does consult. He says to Haman, he consults, what do you think? What do you think about this situation? If someone, it doesn't say who, if someone helps the king, what should be done? What should be the greatest reward, the greatest honor for the person who saves the king's life, etc.? And Haman thinks it's himself that he's going to be honored, because all this time he's the one who's invited to the Mishnah alone with Esther and Ahasuerus. He's the one who had the signet ring to make the decree for the killing the Jews. He's the one who helped Ahasuerus kill his wife last year. He thinks he's the best. So Haman, the advisor, he loves to advise them. He says, he comes up with his whole plan of honor and Pasuk Yud, only to find out that this whole idea of honor is ultimately for his enemy, Mordechai. And he's in shock. So Pasuk Yud Aleph, Haman leads Mordechai through the streets, dressed in royal clothes, on this royal house. And Yud Bet, until the end, describes the busha for Haman, and he goes home despondent to his loving, supportive wife, Zeresh, who tells him that this is his end. Then he has to hurry back to the Mishnah of Esther. Okay? He has to hurry back. Now, this is the same scene, but 24 hours later. Ahasuerus, Esther, Haman at the Mishnah. Okay, but the background is completely different. Ahasuerus understands who this Haman is, what's going on. There's something going on behind him. Ahasuerus now recognizes who Mordechai really is, saved his life. Ahasuerus is now much closer to Esther. Okay?
Why?
Because, like we said before, he's her second feast. Okay?
Only second name?
My lovely queen.
My lovely queen.
My lovely queen. What do you need?
What do you want?
What do you want?
There's also a second aspect of this. Esther, as we know, was the one who told the guards that Mordechai was the one who she related that Mordechai was the one who had saved the king. She's the one who brought the information to the king.
That's how they got
by
the book.
Mordechai. Right, that's how they got the book. So all these things are now in place. Now the scene is becoming revealed. It's illuminating. Now at the Suda, Esther reveals everything. And Ahasuerus is at a point that he can understand and relate to what she's saying. And the final clock that Akashrach puts into place is that Ahasuerus goes out to the courtyard outside of the Suda to think, right? He doesn't immediately say, kill Haman, right? He's pretty far along, but he's not totally far along. So Esther was right in not telling him yesterday, okay? But he's far along, and he's in shock, and he goes out to the courtyard. He's so upset. Here's his major advisor, his confidant, who is totally turned, who is against him, against his wife, who wants to kill his wife's family, et cetera, et cetera. The final clap is that Haman falls on top of Esther. When Ahasuerus comes back into the room, he says, what are you, sitting with my wife? What are you doing in front of me? And that's this, okay?
He's in trouble.
Okay? He's in trouble. And there, who happens to be there? Harvona. Okay? Harvona. This is great. I just saw a little kid dressed as Harvona with his hand pointing, and there was like a gallows, you know, and that was his costume. Because this is the clincher. He just happened to say, oh, Haman had made the gallows overnight, right? And Haman made the gallows overnight. And he points and says, you know what? Hang Haman on those gallows. And that's the ultimate. Haman gets hung on his own gallows. Now, all these pieces...
Becca, to save my life, please.
And all of these pieces, Esther has worked in partnership with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. Hashem has put into place what needs to happen. Esther was putting into place. They're working together in partnership. Now, does she understand everything that Hashem is going to do? No, none of us do. But the point is that she's working with the situation. And the interesting thing about this is when I said that Pirkei Avos, the theme of this would be Lo Alecha Hamlachas Vigmor, Lo Ata Ben Chorin Levatel Mimena. This is in the end of Pirkei Avos, Pirkei Avos. You are not expected to complete the work, but you are not free to evade it. In other words, we have to start, we have to do our part, and Hashem does the rest. It's not as if I can't do anything, so Hashem, you do everything and I'll lie in bed, or I'll just, you know, barely cope. That you have to put in your work, but we have limitations. We can't do all of it. We need to start to do our part, know our strengths, know our capabilities, and push our strengths, push our capabilities, and push beyond our weaknesses. We have that chiyuv in this world. Hashem made us to be that way. On the other hand, we have to know that we can't do everything, that Hashem is there to help us, to make all the other pieces fall into place, to take care of whatever has to be taken care of, that Hashem is there. Hashem will complete the job. We don't have to complete the job. There's an English saying that is very nice. It says, God, please give me the ability to accept that which cannot be changed. I don't know exactly how it works. Cannot change. And the strength to change that which can be changed. And give me the wisdom to distinguish. And give me the wisdom to distinguish between them. We have to use that.
I know.
The alcoholic and other everything else anonymous.
Thank you.
Either way, we have to use our kochot and chachma to act in this world. And we have to also use our kochot and chachma to let go to Hashem in this world. And knowing when to jump and when to hold back and be patient or when to work, well, that's part of life. That's welcome to life, okay? And working with Hashem but in all the little things. If we work with Hashem in every little aspect, making lunch, you know, getting dressed, getting our child dressed, you know, getting to the store. If we're working with Hashem in every little thing, then we'll begin to understand what Hashem wants and work with Hashem. You can't wait till just the big thing happens. And Hashem is always continuously helping, guiding, influencing us. And as we said a few weeks ago in the Gemara, that we said that Hashem, if we don't do tshuva, Hashem says, I will set upon them a king as cool as Haman to force them to do tshuva. Hashem can't make us into Bali tshuva. He can't make us Bali tshuva. He can only set the circumstances to help us become each one of us, a Baal Teshuva at every moment in our lives. But he can't take away our free will, our independence, our kochos. He made us a Tzelem Elokim. The Tzelem Elokim part of us is our independence, our strength, our ability to choose to be Avde Hashem, to choose to give up to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. But it's a choice. Now, I'm out of time, but I also wanted to just present how this works between people, because I think it's just really important. It was a major limud for me that the idea, we've been talking about Malchus and through the entire Megillat Esther, the idea of Malchus. And this is what Malchus really is, to know when and how to guide, to direct, to inspire yourself or another person, okay, to be all that they can be, to help them maximize their own potential. But you can't force them to be what you want them to be, and you can't force them, and you can't take their problem from them. You can't absorb their problem, make it your problem, and you fix it. You can't do it. Hashem, and that's what Hashem treats us. He sets Teva in motion. He's created the whole world. It's seven layers. Esther had to walk through seven corridors, seven doors to get to Kadosh Baruch Hu. He's created this for a reason, for us to work. He sets Teva in motion. He guides, hints, helps, whatever it is, to get us to act. But he lets us ultimately use our own free will to get there, to make decisions, to develop our own potential, to retain choice and independence, but to get there. Now, I just want to give you, and that's what he wants us to do in our own lives. That's how he treats us, and that's how he wants us to treat other people and to treat ourselves as well. I'm going to give it, like, child reading, right? If you sit there and the child's learning how to read and we just want to say the words, right? It'd be a lot easier just to say the words for that child, right? You can't. The child will never learn to read. An amazing experience just a week ago. There's a boy who, a student of my husband, and he called the other day, and he left a message on the phone machine. And I picked up the machine, and the first two sentences were all stuttering. Incredible stuttering. And, of course, I know what he's saying. He said, I'm calling, da-da-da. I know what he's saying. But I was forced to sit there and listen to the sentence. And then the rest of the message was clear as could be. Not one stuttering. And that's how he is. And he came for Shabbat. And the beginning of any conversation is always the first word or two, or the first sentence is incredible stuff, and you just want to say the first word or two for him. You just want to say it to get him out of his misery. If I say it, I destroy him. I destroy his confidence, and I destroy his ability to learn how to say it. He gets help, Baruch Hashem. He's an incredible person. He gets his, he's had his tutors and his, there's skills, there's ways, there's help, but if you say it for him, you destroy him. Completely destroy him. You cannot take someone's problem from them, because the Kadosh Baruch Hu made it their problem, and therefore it's their tikkun, and therefore they have to go through the problem, they have to do it. We can guide them, help them, help them develop skills, get them the best education, get them whatever it takes, right? What it's daven for them. But
Show them patience.
But our role is to be the helper, not the solver, not the doer, not the person with the problem. Hashem would have made us stutter, or would have made us the problem. If that was it, Mordechai cannot do Esther's job. Mordechai, Esther says, I'm sending you clothes. She sent him all these royal clothes. Get out of your mourning clothes and go to talk to Ahasuerus. She says, no, I'm not taking the clothes. I cannot. This is Esther's tikkun. She has to go to Ahasuerus. And Al Pi Teva, he couldn't go and ask Ahasuerus. It wasn't going to do any good, right, for him to go and ask Ahasuerus to save Klal Yisrael. Esther had to, this was her job, her tikkun. He could only stand outside the courtyard, outside the king's gate, and send her messages. You know, this is what you have to do, this is why you have to do it. He's talking to her through this way. He cannot go inside and do it for her. It's not his job. It won't work. That's not the world. The world is not going to be saved. Christ is not going to be saved through him. Mordechai is the guide, the advisor, the support, the influence, but Esther has to go into the king, ultimately alone. Now, she had the support of Mordechai, she had the tefillah and fasting of Christ well, but ultimately no one else can do it. No one else. But this boy could pronounce those words to get them out of his mouth. No one else. There are a million examples of such situations. There was a boy when I was teaching, we had a course where they had to build models. The idea, they didn't have to know how to build models for their life. They're not going to go out and build models and, you know, architectural models. The idea was to give them confidence, to give them something other than intellectual learning. These boys had other learning disabilities. So it was to give them confidence. And many times, boys who can't do intellectual learning can build beautiful projects using their hands. So this one boy, his older brother was excellent at this. The requirement that I had was that in class, they had to build in class. That was the requirement. The building was all done in class. We had materials, et cetera. This boy was sick for about 3 weeks. He comes in with this beautiful structure, which I knew perfectly well. I had his older brother in class 3 years before. I knew perfectly he didn't build that building. And he insisted. Now, I knew that it was destroyed his self-confidence that his brother did it for him. Destroying the whole idea was for him to have self-confidence. Destroyed him. His brother took away. Yes, he had this beautiful project. It didn't belong to him. And when we finally made a city with all these little projects, this boy had the project of his brother. And for three months after that, I tried to get him to build something, anything. And he wouldn't do it. He lost. It was not his project. It was not his tikkun. It was not his building. Sarah, just real quick, Sarah gave her spiritual genes, right? Her 127 years to Esther. That's what we said in the previous class, right? What was Sarah? Sarah put into Yitzchak, her son, all her kochos, all her spiritual strength. She built in her son Yitzchak, so he could be the next Avos, right? And he could be the son of Abraham to carry on, to build the Jewish people, to fill his tafkid in this world. There were Farshim that say that if she lived a complete, it says 127 years, Rashi said, as a tzedekah, pure, going from the 7 to 100 to the 7, the 20, the 100, she was so close to Hashem. Then the Farshim say, how could she die from hearing that it says that the Satan came and said to her, Yitzchak died. So, and then she said she cried and she died. So they said, how could she die from Yitzchak? She knew that they were going to sacrifice Yitzchak. Why would she die? The opposite. She knew that her tafkid was complete, that she had put into Yitzchak everything to be able to be Mesiris Nefesh, to kill himself for her Kaddish Baruch Hu, to sacrifice his life. That she knew she had put in everything, and now she'd finished her tafkid. She could not be Yitzchak and go and sacrifice herself. That wasn't her tafkid. Her tafkid was to put into Yitzchak on his entire childhood all the strength to be able to do what a Kaddish Baruch Hu wants. And that was her job. Now she could rest in peace. She could only guide him to that point. It goes on and on. Barak and Devorah. Devorah had to convince Barak he had to go to war. That they had to go to war. And that another woman would actually be the one to do the tikkun. That was Yael in the end. She couldn't do Yael's job. She had to do her job, which is send them to war, to tell them to go. Anyway, the real malchus, as we say, is to guide, to inspire, to lead, to educate. This is real chinuch. To lead another person, people, students, a nation, to do their tafkid, to develop their potential, to fulfill their job. Even Esther cannot complete the job. Lo hamlacha ligmur. Right? Lo hamlacha ligmur. She cannot complete the job. At this point, Ahasuerus cannot. Here she's told him that, you know, what Haman plans to do, and now they're hanging Haman. But the problem isn't resolved, because decree has already gone out to kill the Jews. In another 11 months on Adar, the Jews are supposed to be, a decree is hanging over their heads to be killed. We have a decree about this war with Iraq. Okay? What are they going to do? It is against the law of the land to retract that decree. Now, the law of the land came from Kaddish Baruch Hu. Right? What happens? She suggests, in Parasite, she suggests, let's make a new decree allowing the Jews to fight back. This is the only solution that they can come up with of how to resolve this problem. Inform the Jews that there will be such a situation, it will be such and such a day, they can be armed, they can be et cetera, and they will fight back. So here we come, that the Jewish people, 127 provinces, are going to fight back. This is their tafkid. They had to daven, and now they have to fight physically. This is their part that only they can do. Esther can't do any more than that for them. She has set into place everything that she possibly can. She can't do the last part. Remember, this is the third part. The davening was the first part. The gift, Esther's whole su'ud, et cetera, was the second part. Now this is the third part, the fighting. This is right from Yaakov, the fighting. Now, of course, Hashem is behind all of it. And ultimately, he's saving us. He's putting all the pieces into place. But we have our part to do. We can't just sit back and say Hashem's going to do it all. We have an actual physical part to do. And we have to do it. The davening, the gift, all that hishtabah that Esther does, and now the fighting. It says they went out and fight and they killed. This is part of our assignment, part of our job. That's what they had to do. It's a few psukim that talk about how many were killed on such and such day, and the second day, et cetera, and that's why we have in Yerushalayim and any walled city in the world, there's 2 days because they actually went out and killed for 2 days to completely wipe out Amalek. The idea was to get rid of all of Amalek. All of any, in that generation, any anti-Semite, if you will. I'm really not anti-Semite. That's such a bad word. There's no Semite are people that also hate Arabs. The Arabs hate themselves. So anyway, this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu putting everything into place in order to wipe out from that door, that generation, people who hate Jews.
They didn't, but they
obviously they're still Amalek, but from that provinces in the 127 provinces at that of most of the civilized world, most whoever had risen up to fight the Jews on that, remember, at this point, they don't have to fight the Jews. They don't, the people that rise up are the ones who still hate the Jews. Okay, even after they know of the situation that Esther is the queen and Esther is a Jew, and now that the decree that they can fight back, these people still go out and fight. That's a real Jew hater. Okay, but the Jews now are armed and can fight back. So anyone who still rises up on that day, okay, is being slaughtered. Now this, I just want to end here. So the aspect about this is that all these coincidences throughout the Megillah, coincidences in quotes, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Anything in our life, all of these pieces are HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But they can either create doubt or they could create amuna. Which goes back to the very beginning of Tefillah. Hamakom mirachok. Hashem puts himself far away. The whole time during this period, Klal Yisrael felt that Hashem had abandoned them. Esther felt Hashem had abandoned them. Everyone feels Hashem is far away. You can either have doubt and assimilate or depressed or whatever before I mentioned before, all these different things that we can do, anger, et cetera, whatever, or you can create emunah. But it's our free will choice. It's a free will choice to see behind the Teva Hashem's signature. And it's to see that it's coincidence or not. And this is the whole Megillah. Hashem is working behind the scenes, and we can join in or not join in. It's basically our ultimate free will choice to join in or not join in this master plan. And that's the whole Megillah is showing us, all the different places that Hashem is working, that He's running a master plan, where we can join or not join. Or Hashem can work through us for the good or for the bad. Either way. And at the end, when we say Baruch Marachai or Ar Haman, to curse Haman or to bless Mordechai, because ultimately Hashem is reaching the same goal. He's worked through each one of them. Okay, He's working through Esther, but He's working through each one. Through the blessing, through the merit of Mordechai, or through the evil of Haman. And either way, we're going to get to that place, but we'd rather work through Mordechai. Right, because ultimately, you should get so drunk you don't know the difference, because ultimately Kadosh Baruch Hu has a master plan, and he's going to do it either way, and he's going to work through the world, and we can choose which way to go.